Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are continuing our interesting discussion with Art Rosengarten about the tarot, psychology, archetypes, and the transition into the new, or the unconditioned, as Art mentioned in the first segment. I want to talk a little bit more about nine now. Art, you mentioned numerology before. You mentioned the matrix of the nine paths, and of course your new deck is featured around the nine. And this is a number that definitely have been coming up. I've been keeping an eye on this as well. It seems to be primarily in the context of different esoteric areas that this comes up. And I certainly have my own kind of interpretation and ideas about this. But I want to hear about you. What do you consider to be so important with nine, or what does it represent to you?
Nine is a magical number, and it symbolizes the completion of the spiritual man, whereas from a numerological standpoint, seven, one could say, symbolizes the completion of the material man. In the Tarot of the Nine Paths, in the lexicon that comes in a book that comes with the deck, this is some of what some of the words that I have used to describe the nine, which is a very remarkable symbol. Wisdom and tenacity in the pursuit of true self, individuation, the process by which a person becomes a psychological individual, that's Jung, self-realization, fierce independence, a master of the invisible, philosopher, artist, cares little for outside approval, values aloneness, independence, and finally, as the Buddha instructed, for all travelers, he seeks his own salvation with diligence. That is all describing basically the symbolism of the number nine as it is manifest in tarot, in the tarot card, the Hermit.
Yes.
Now, this is the thing about the Hermit archetype is, one, it's been very much misunderstood in our modern culture and associated with its shadow side, which is, you know, to be an isolate, to be a loner, to be, or else it's kind of fairy tale side of the kind of old man out in the woods in a cabin being a hermit. But what the hermit, I guess, is not correctly understood about this universal symbol is it really is the energy of the individual pursuing meaning and their own path in a very tenacious way. And so this deck that I really came out of my vision and study of the magical properties of nine is completely based on the both the symbolism and the numerology of nineness. Now, nine, as when you look at the as a number, nine is unique in that any number multiplied by nine reduces to nine again.
Yes.
Right? So yep. you multiply 3 times 9, you have 27, then you add across in what's called mystic addition, 2 plus 7, and it comes back to 9.
Yes.
Now, the amazing thing about that is it continues with virtually all numbers. For instance, if we were to look at the number of genes in the estimated in the human genome, 62,598, if you were to take that long number, or virtually any number, and break that and multiply it by 9, in this case, I've already done it, so I know that the answer is 563,382, this long number. Now, if you were to add those numbers across, 5 plus 6, etc., it again would end in 9. That's interesting. Second thing about 9 is when it's added to any of the primary digits, numeric reduction restores the original number. So you add 1 plus 9, you get 10. Now, if you add that 10 across 1-0, it comes back to where you started, the 1. 2 plus 9, 11, then you have 1-1, goes back to the 2, etc. The conclusion is that I've made in this work paradoxically returns to essence. And three, expansion occurs with retention of root value or origin. Now, these are kind of summary statements of what happens metaphysically and mathematically when you move into nineness and you start empowering anything with this kind of unique magical symbol. That's what the Tarot of the Nine Paths is completely based on. It's bringing the what I call the hermit effect into each of the 22 plus 5 or 27 trump cards of the tarot and empowering them or hermetizing them with these magical properties.
And before you mentioned some of the properties, I guess, of the hermit. Would you say that these are important properties in regards to where we're going? And where, again, you mentioned this before about the moving into the unconditioned in that sense. And what I get from that is this idea about you don't actually, doesn't mean that you're mean or not considerate of other people and so forth, but you really don't care in that sense about what other people think of you. You follow your own path no matter what, and you dare to go your own road, right?
Exactly correct. And the reason why, as you say, this is important at this time is it embodies the energy that faces powerful collective energies, like you mentioned in Sweden, and we have them everywhere, from the perspective of the individual, and basically empowers the individual to walk their own true path right through these powerful collective archetypal energies, if that's where they go, without needing the approval or the collective support, but empowered to do their own thing, so to speak, to self-actualize. Now, it takes a lot of determination and just force of will to move through culture and all the collective forces with that kind of directiveness of the hermit. Now, in that service, I think the conclusion, and certainly in the tarot, it goes well beyond the hermit. That is more the vehicle. But the ultimate, I think, destination is beyond tarot. It's the unconditioned. And that is very much like pure being, it's been called, or you know, in the Eastern space, they speak of liberation or enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of the goal, where it's an open and pure space where there is no conditioning. There just is, if you will. It's really in the popular culture, it's now being referred to as the power of now, and I agree. I think it's that energy. Now, the hermit and some of these other archetypes can be used by we travelers who are trying to kind of figure it out in our lives. These symbols can be used to help us go down true paths in our lives beyond the resistance of the collective. And so, yeah, I guess that's a long way of answering your question.
You mentioned collective archetypal energies. Is there a specific archetype that you can mention, or even an archetype that have gotten a certain god or goddess associated with them that you can mention? And who would these be?
Well, certainly, you know, each of these tarot cards are certainly associated with a zodiacal astrological energy that manifests in different religious systems. But in terms of gods and goddesses, some are, you know, for instance, Mary, Mother Mary, or Tara, or Kuan Yin. It carries the deep archetypal mother goddess energy. Each one of the tarot cards is associated with certain, you know, various religions emphasize some or others of these archetypes. I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure. Yeah. Well, absolutely. It's interesting, and in that regard, would you say when we think of Mother Mary, then from the Western world perspective, again, Catholicism, has this been, in your eyes, representing this collective force of you know, grouping everyone together in the sense, and it's very goes against the idea of the hermit. Would you say that that's the idea?
Well, yeah, that may be so. I think that when you first asked the question, the card that to me seemed certainly in America, but I think maybe in the whole Western world, the card that seemed to be the eclipsing card of our time was the Tower card.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly with 9/11 and the consciousness of that has really sprung ever since the, you know, this century, has been a kind of a response. I mean, the actual World Trade Center catastrophe was, I mean, it was just, and you, if you look at the tarot's tower card, I mean, it actually was a literal enactment of the symbolism of this very dramatic card.
Yes.
And so we live in a post-tower period, if you will, on that level. And the thing about the tower card, which is one of the, people would say is one of the difficult cards of the major arcana, that along with, say, death and the devil card and a few others, but each card has a positive and negative aspect, and so does the tower. Now, the tower card in the tarot it certainly is an archetype of the destructive qualities, but also there are some really important lessons in the tower, and mostly they're symbolized by the lightning in the lightning struck tower. The lightning bolt that is going into the structure or the tower, you know, you could say the ivory tower of our kind of unconscious modern lifestyle, was getting pummeled by this lightning bolt. We talk about Thor and the power of the Vajra lightning bolt. That is can be interpreted certainly as a symbol of laser light awareness or intense mind.
Yeah.
So in the tower card, the teaching is to react instantaneously, immediately, like a lightning bolt, to this this ultimate catastrophic condition where you are crumbling from the inside and being attacked from the outside. And this, the result is the lightning bolt is getting out of the tower immediately to safe ground. Now, that's very transformational. It's very powerful. Instant enlightenment, transformational.
Hmm.
So, if you want to talk about certainly the culture that when I think of cultural influences in the tarot card, you know, I believe we're living in America, certainly, a post-tower age. At least the Bush administration was all about that.
Yeah.
And what was certainly the new president here, Obama, who we all are very happy with so far, that the response to it is to use that lightning bolt to now move forward very rapidly onto a fertile ground. And so there's a teaching in that image, as is found in all the tarot cards, that there is a lesson, both a positive and negative aspect, that we can learn from.
Interesting. And would you say that those people who didn't, in that regard, then get out in time, symbolically speaking here, weren't able to pass through this time or this.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. This rite of passage, and I in my deck I see that, you know, with the nine it sets the major arcana into a matrix of three rows of nine, and that there's a line, there's nine lines, that's the nine paths, and each of those triads of those three cards that form a line, I call a rite of passage. And if you look at the logic and the meta teaching in these lines, you'll see that what is revealed in this deck is really clear rites of passage through these difficult challenges. Now, with the tarot, if your card comes in reversed, as I'm sure people who have read tarot cards know, that they can come in upside down.
Yes.
That usually carries more the shadow aspect. Now, when we're talking about the tower card, as you're saying that, it reminds me of there's a wonderful tarot author and teacher, Rachel Pollack, who you may know. She's quite well known. But she made an interesting comment about the tower card when it's reversed. And what that points to, she says, is being stuck in the dungeon below the tower.
Hmm.
And I think that that's a really great metaphor, because I think that that's where a lot of the stuck places in response to the tower are. They're in the tower reverse. They're underneath the tower, and all this rapid, you know, upheaval is occurring, and the response to it is occurring, but there are some people that have tunneled down underneath in the dungeon below the tower and are living underground in this very trapped and stuck place where they're like shackled beneath the tower. And that's is a brilliant symbol for a mind state, a condition that I think operates on some parts of society, that with a tarot card and one who can talk about it in this way, it's a mirror that you can begin to locate what's happening not only in your own personal psyche, but what's happening in your whole community. It's like our community is stuck in the dungeon beneath the tower.
Hmm.
So that's how these images, these visual images and archetypes can be useful.
Could it be that that has been a choice for some people as well? They're kind of huddled in fear under the tower, and this gives them a kind of a false sense of security, maybe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that brings up the interesting point is that the ultimate solution with tarot, as I see it, is awareness. And it's not necessarily that we identify with the good gods or the positives and we avoid the bad.
Sure.
More that we in a way we are become aware of the whole archetype, positive and negative. And that we, in a way, distance ourselves or separate from it through awareness, where we can see that that is the underlying structure of our conditioned world, maybe on its purest level. And there's also now a choice where there's the unconditioned. That's what I talked about earlier, where, you know, that whole thing is constructed. Even on the archetypal level, it's a constructed reality, and the choice is that actually we don't have to go to either side of the tower, really. We can see it and learn from it, but we can choose to actually come into fresh, immediate, present-centered awareness now, apart from this huge cultural and psychological energy that's operating in our field.
Yes. Well, I know that you talked about this in the DVD, The Great Work, something I really resonated with, this idea that what we perceive to be negative or a bad thing or an event or whatever, that actually necessarily don't have to be a negative or bad thing. This could also be a sign of opportunity for change, or rather something that we should in one way kind of embrace instead of avoid or running away from it, right?
Well, I agree. And I think it's tempting, and even in our respective fields where people that kind of listen to this show and are interested in these sorts of so-called alternative ideas, etc., there is, I think, a danger and a fascination to get really invested in the shadow side and to look at, you know, doomsday stuff and to look at, you know, to get, you know, the 2012 end times kind of fantasies and to actually make, you know, put a lot of energy behind them and also get into the self-fulfilling prophecy dimension of that.
Yes.
And so that's something that we need to watch out for.
Well, exactly. It's a very good point. I think it's could it also be that people and, you know, are fascinated by these things because they on some level they do actually need to experience the shadow in that sense that they've been avoiding it for such a long time. So when it finally hits them, when they come into alternative research and material, there's almost a craving or a wanting for this, the apocalypse, if you know what I mean, in a symbolic term again, or an individual term, the apocalypse, their own personal apocalypse, that they want to live through this because that is actually the catalyst that makes them do the changes that is necessary to move on. What do you think?
That's a very good insight. And I think that's true. There's, you know, I think probably Freud talked about that as the death wish.
Yes.
And it does, in a way, become inviting. It does, in a way, become fascinating. There's a part of the psyche that says, okay, well, let's go with it. Let's just blow it all up. There's something that is kind of appealing in this irrational way, almost addictive, to just get into this dark. You know, it kind of drives a lot of the types of movies that we tend to go watch and see. There's a fascination with the shadow.
Yes.
It's a saying in like all the American Westerns, you know, when all of a sudden the guy with the black hat rode into town, you know, all the ladies in the bar got very, very stimulated. You know, they all came rushing out to look at the bad man who's come into town.
Yes.
And there's something just very, I don't know, stimulating, almost erotic about, you know, going into this intensity of the shadow. But I do believe that is can be a real trap as well.
It could be, and I guess how would you say is it important then up to a certain point, meaning that you need to identify the shadow or you know what the dark side of yourself is, if you know what I mean, in that regard, but not get trapped by the allure by it. But you need to awaken the shadow in yourself, but you also need to work with it or overcome it, I guess.
Well, yes, but I think that there's a potential problem of calling it a thing and turning it into a something that you have to get rid of or that you have to explore. And that kind of thinking is really lends itself to the all kinds of dualistic, polarizing thoughts of, you know, the good part and the bad part.
Or, sure.
You know, and the problem is not the content there, but it's the process of thinking in those types of polarities and dualities that I think ultimately is the cause of the content.
Hmm.
And rather than coming from a more non-dualistic place.
Right, right. And what do you think people need to do to get over that, or you know, to stop thinking in the dualistic terms or sense of things?
Well, I think that you begin to, you know, you start to realize that one, language reveals a lot. It really, and it's not something that you want to get over, quote, get over, because there's nothing really there.
Hmm.
It's a construction of mind and nothing more. And so rather than getting over it, it's more just being aware of to them very far. You just let them be there and dissolve, and you try to hold it in the present moment without adding on to it.
Mm.
That's awareness. And I think that is really the solution.
How about integration from the Jungian point of view then? Is that a similar way of dealing with it, or is that still giving credence to it, or giving it energy, or verifying it? What do you think?
Well, that's a paradox, isn't it?
It is.
And so it's working with integration and inclusive of that paradoxical quality of integration, where on this non-dual perspective, there's really nothing to integrate.
Hmm.
So I think that you have to be careful about getting too literal with these terms, and that the more you can present what's underneath these distinctions that we're making, like, you know, the healthy and the unhealthy, and the more that you can get underneath those words and those ideas to present a basic level of being or awareness, where you see those are just relative concepts that don't really matter. As they're used.
Yes.
That's what the unconditioned is about.
And in one sense also, I mean, this is what the signals, if you will, that the world is giving us all the time. Hot, cold, you know, white, black. You know, you have summer, winter, you have death, life.
It moves product. It sells. It's in a basic consumerist economy and worldview, I'm afraid. Polarization basically creates the illusion of need, and it's good for business, I guess. Fortunately, you know, people, you know, buy into the illusion, and they take it literally, and they start believing that there is something there, that it's real, when it's not. It's conditioned. It's kind of self-created.
Hmm.
These distinctions that we make.
Really? So even in terms of what we can see in the world, both in a symbolic way, or nature, if we look at it from the point of view of nature, I certainly see that there is a duality in nature, that how things, the interaction down from the, you know, from the subatomic level up to the macrocosm level. In that sense, I see that there's a duality in creation. But do you think that that's but yet at the same time, this is the paradox, as you said before, I see that,
well,
it's all part of the same thing, right?
I would ask you where that duality lies, where it exists.
It exists in me, of course, because I'm observing it.
Right. But does it exist from its own side, or is it just from your side?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Is the reality objective, or is it subjective, you know?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And I don't know at this point. How about you?
Well, but that's a good question that doesn't necessarily need to be answered.
Sure.
The question itself is a good place to rest a little bit and consider.
Absolutely. That's a meditation, I guess, in that sense.
Exactly.
Hmm. That's very, very interesting. I want to ask you a little bit, if we backtrack, I guess, a little bit here, and talk about the unconditioned, and mentioned in the first segment, at the end of the first segment, about talking about the importance of history in that regard, how much we can look at history, learn from history, and kind of keep that with us in one sense, but yet still potentially progressing or moving into this, the realm of the unconditioned. Is that something that is doable, or do we have to leave history and the idea of history behind us? Is that a problem at all? What do you think?
Well, that's a great question. I certainly think that, I don't know if I can answer that in the way that you're asking it. I certainly think that there's a lot to learn from history, and that, you know, things do tend to repeat themselves, and history is a great window into patterns that tend to other hand, history is, in certain ways, I think history is a big illusion. I think what we call history is a story that is reported to us through historians, and is about a certain way, a certain narrative about what happened that is very generalized and is not really what experience in life is about, is what you read in history books.
Yeah.
It makes for good stories. But, you know, as Jung talked about, what really is at the essence of human history, what really marked the changes in the course of human history, has never been, nor could ever be, reported in books and in records, because it exists in the depths of the human soul,
yes,
human experience.
That's a good point. And would you make a distinction even, and I'm generalizing in terms here, of course, but would you make a distinction between official history and, if you will, the alternative view of history?
Yes, I certainly do. I do think that the alternative views of history are, you know, really interesting, such as, say, the pyramids were built, you know, 5,000 years earlier than what is commonly believed to be true, and that sort of thing. All of that information is very fascinating and interesting, but possibly for different reasons, I think. Not because the alternative picture has it right,
sure,
necessarily,
sure,
but that the alternative picture begins to relativize our belief system that what we learned in school was necessarily, you know, written in stone. And alternative views of history kind of open up the relativity behind a lot of, you know, our beliefs and a lot of our knowledge base.
So would you say that by studying the alternative view of history, that's potentially more important in regards to just opening you up to new possibilities than actually just giving you the true version of what actually happened?
Well,
and so
I think so. You know, now tying that back into my tarot deck, TNP, one of the things that I've done is, you know, it's an established tradition in the tarot, in something called constellations, tarot constellations, to be able to break dates, mostly birth dates, into particular cards in the tarot. So what's commonly done is computing one's soul and personality card based on the numbers in their birth date, and then it essentially supposedly reflects core parts of who you are, which is very interesting. Now, what I've done is I've computed a year chart, and I've done it over the last 100 years, from 50 years back to 50 years in the future from now, just for sake of time,
mm-hmm,
based on an unfolding of numbers associated with the years, which have correspondence in tarot cards. So you see that there's a different pattern. I know that sounds kind of complex, but it's not really. When you look at numerology and you see how numbers, like say the year 2009, if you just add a cross, you get an 11, you know, 2009, which is the justice card in the tarot.
Mm.
Next year, 2010, which would actually add up to the 3, would be the Empress card. So you begin to, and you start looking at dates in history, and what you'll find on the esoteric level is that there's an underlying symbolic story that is unfolding simultaneously with these symbols that are operating underneath conscious calendars. And if you wanted to look for an alternative history, if we're talking about that, you know, I could, you know, easily, or anyone working with this deck of cards, say, and the charts that are included in the book that I've written, could begin to look at an unfolding of these archetypal principles based on actually even the day's date, when you just start to add up, you know, the day of the week and the date and the year, you'll get a four-digit number when you start reducing across. And then you can very quickly go into a chart and find, you know, a tarot card that's associated, a trump card, with that particular day or moment. And you see that it works in this interesting way, in that it's both rational and linear, where numbers kind of go 5, 6, 7, 8, and then it jumps in this very irrational, nonlinear way because of numerology, and it may go from, you know, just off the top of my head, you know, it may go from like 21, 22, 23, 4.
Yeah.
This, and so you begin to follow an alternative history based on a symbol system. And why that is useful is because it basically opens up another way of thinking. It you begin to, in this, like you suggested, this alternative perception of time and history, and it returns you really to the soul, and to how we're all kind of like living in a dream, and there's these things that are happening outside of us that are mirroring our own soul unfoldment.
Hmm.
I don't know if that was too way out there.
No, it's very interesting indeed. And one thing that also I come to think of when you mentioned that is this only applicable in that sense to the Gregorian calendar, or have you looked at other calendar systems as well, and it works on the same level there?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, that's, you know, that's where a lot of my future work is. You know, there's basically, what I've done is I've come up with a matrix that can be applied to, I think, virtually anything, any system, and there are certain deep archetypal interrelationships between universal principles, like wisdom and death, dissolution, or war in the tarot. And this kind of, this basic grid work allows you to go into mathematics or words and ideas and break them down in these core structures, core archetypal structures of the tarot, with pictures that begin to weave this pattern where everything is interconnected. One of the new cards, you know, I mentioned early in the interview that I did this because I saw that the tarot was incomplete and it needed 5 cards. So I basically found the infrastructure of the major arcana, and then using that logic, I inferred the missing 5 cards. One of them is this card, which I call the Great Web. It's the final card of this deck. And it's the principle of interdependency. You know how everything is interconnected with everything else in the universe?
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you.
Yeah. And I use the word, coming from the wonderful Vietnamese Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't know if you're familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh.
No, I'm not.
He's quite well known in Buddhist circles, but he has this wonderful word that he created that describes it, which is interbeing. He kind of coined that phrase, and it really has the significance of interdependency, and it relates to that Buddhist notion of mutual co-arising, how things kind of co-arise together. And the bottom line is that everything is interrelated with everything else, and it's in a great web. So I guess one of the goals of certainly my work is to get closer and closer to that experience of interbeing, classical mystical symbol system, is you begin to see that everything kind of relates to everything else in ordinary living. Just, you know, pouring a glass of water or, you know, talking to your spouse or whatever. That there is this divine dance that's operating in everything that we do. And so as that becomes more obvious, becomes more present in momentary experience, you know, I do believe that's what higher consciousness is all about.
Interesting. And so it isn't in that regard about taking off to somewhere else, if you know what I mean, but it actually is about being even more here in that sense. Again, that term that you used before, being in the present, or the power of now in that sense, to use the Eckhart Tolle version of this.
Well, absolutely. And I think, Eckhart Tolle has done a beautiful job at just very clearly framing that. And I would totally agree with that.
Hmm. How about the, I mean, because again, one thing that often comes up when you talk about these things is that the ego in that sense is something that we need to get rid of or learn to harness and so forth. What's your take on the ego? Does that fulfill an important role in our lives, and do we need to work with that again, or do we need to get rid of it, as some people actually do suggest? What do you think?
Well, you know, the problem with the ego is the word. It's one of those words that has gotten so confused in the language, we don't even know what we're talking about anymore when we talk about the word ego. You know, from a technical, pure psychological standpoint, the ego is a good thing. What we're generally referring to when we talk about ego in a more popular way is egotism or narcissism.
Yes.
And you know, that's like inappropriately self-concerned. But it's not something that you do away with because it really doesn't exist. There is no real ego. Ego is just a word, and it describes, I think, a collective belief that we have that is the problem. And the belief is that I exist in my body, and I am this kind of, you know, I exist inside my skin and in these thoughts, and I am this the separate entity and this self. And I think that's probably the first construction that gets us into some difficulty. I mean, I think it may be instinctive in our growth that we need to find out where we're located, where we exist. So as children, we start off growing. We need to kind of claim our body and claim our realm. And that's when the ego starts forming. But I think a lot of ego is based on defending that ground, defending that territory from the perception of threat.
Hmm. And that can be important at times, right?
Yeah, but it acting skillfully is important.
Right.
Certainly, survival is important. The problem is, I guess, that there's the problem of projection, where we have this unconscious tendency of projecting threat all around us when it's not there.
Hmm.
And then we defend against it.
Yes.
There's, if you go out and you go out in nature and you, I'm always struck by, of course there is the Darwinian world out there, and things get eaten by other bigger things. But it's a more it's a kinder and more peaceful place than in human nature. In human society, it just seems like there is definitely a kind of aggressiveness that's a kind of a permutation. There's an aggressiveness and that whole syndrome around that. I mean, we could go on for that,
yes.
about that.
It's
driven by, you know, as the Buddha taught, you know, 2,500 years ago, you know, the three poisons, the false belief of, you know, basically hatred, greed, and delusion.
Mm.
It's at the core of the human ego. It's driven by these primary drives that are based on illusion. You know, that they're insufficient. They don't exist. They're just imagined. That's the problem.
And
right there.
Yeah, and this is a big question that we can spend a lot of time on, of course, but to keep it fairly short before we begin to round things up here for this time, Art,
sure.
would you say that, or rather, what is it that makes us so different than from nature? If we're a product of nature and a part of that, why do we have some of the properties that you, I guess you would say then, you don't see in nature?
Well, yeah, you know, in transpersonal psychology, this is called the pre-trans fallacy, you know, by Ken Wilber. It's an interesting discussion. And what that's about is the pre-egoic state, you know, we could call it nature, but you could even imagine, you know, the magical child energy, the pure child coming in. Is that the same energy as the enlightened master? The trans-personal, pre-personal and the trans-personal. And there has long been this, I think, romanticized notion that, you know, the pure infant is no different than the enlightened being.
Mm.
There's not, and you might even say that that nature itself, or the, you know, the natural animal in its habitat is no different than the consciousness of the enlightened Swami. But what Ken Wilber beautifully has argued, and I would agree with that, is no, they're not the same. It's I think the problem is these are the growing pains of consciousness. We're very immature and young, just like an adolescent in our egos, and you know we're very emotional and reactive and filled with fantasies and. Have all kinds of hormones operating collectively as a human race in our evolution, but I think these are growing pains. I believe that they're you know the final arrival or destination of human consciousness is an integration of these challenges that these higher psycho spiritual themes. It's really the tarot is really about, Eric, that at some point integrates the entire human psyche to operate on a much more advanced level than it is now.
Hmm.
And so what we're reacting to, you know, is a kind of a young teenager's bad behavior, the human species. I don't, whether we survive long enough to reach full maturity, That's the question.
That's the big question, absolutely. And in that regard, I think that I would agree with you as well that we're just, you know, starting to explore these areas. And again, I also see that it's not kind of maybe not even a final destination in that sense, but it's actually about the journey of continuing and evolving and transforming all the time in that sense.
Absolutely. And that the exciting thing, like we talked earlier about the lightning bolt of the tower, that at any moment, even in states of chaos and upheaval, like the world is often in these days, at any moment there is the potentiality of that lightning bolt to strike and to experience a satori or sudden opening, sudden enlightenment.
Mm.
And I think that's the thing. In the long run, you know, it looks like we're in for a long and difficult ride in the future. However, simultaneously, there is always the possibility that some extraordinary events or awarenesses can manifest, and things can change very, very quickly and dramatically. And I, you know, I'm a proponent of that. So, yeah, I'm a pretty optimistic person about the future. I'm like a number of people I know.
Absolutely. Well, I am too, and I would definitely agree with that. And I think that that's a positive note to begin to round things up on
sure.
For this time, Art. This has been really interesting, and I've really enjoyed having you with us here today. I want to thank you again for your time. But before we end, please mention your website again and how people can get a copy of your latest deck and the guidebook that comes along with that.
Right. Well, you can see on my website, it's just artrosengarten.com. You will see I have at least 100 articles that you can read and see, short articles on interesting subjects, including my work with the Tarot and Psychology and the Tarot of the Nine Paths. I'm now beginning to take orders for TMP, or Tarot of the Nine Paths, and you can just hit the you know, the order button there, and I will put you on a list and notify you when the decks are available. And they will also be available on Amazon.com and bookstores at that time, but you probably will be able to get to it quicker if you contact me directly on my website.
Very good. And the website again is artrosengarten.com. We will have this linked up on redicecreations.com. I also want to mention again, for people who are interested, the great work, DVD, head on over to magicalegypt.com and check that out, which Art is included in Lon Milo Duquette that we interviewed about a week ago here. So head on over to their website, check that out. And again, I want to thank you very much, Art, for coming on. And we'd love to have you back at some point and continue talking more with you if you're up for that, Art.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I would absolutely love to come back on. It was a great experience for me.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Art. Take good care. That's our program with Art Rosengarten. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back on Sunday with more radio. My name is Henrik. My thanks to Fredrik and everyone supporting Red Ice and everyone helping us to spread the word about our website, radio programs, and videos. Take good care, and we will talk more soon. Bye-bye.